Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the bombshell revelations by NBC News and The Intercept about the Kushner family shakedown of the Qatari government for a $500 million loan to bail out Jared's unwise investment in 666 Fifth Avenue, a financial albatross which has a $1.4 billion balloon payment due in February. Ryan Grimm, the D.C. bureau chief for The Intercept, joins us to discuss his latest article at The Intercept, Jared Kushner's real estate firm sought money directly from Qatar government weeks before blockade. We will look into the extraordinary nature of the self-dealing going on in the Trump White House, where the lines between government duties and private business are all but erased, with Jared Kushner representing the United States in some of the most important and sensitive portfolios in our government, all the while raising money for his family's troubled real estate business that is threatened by Jared's 2007 vanity purchase of the most expensive building in Manhattan, which is underwater and could take down the Kushner brand. Then we'll speak with Timothy Canova, a professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University, who teaches regulation of international financial institutions, international business transactions, and international trade and development law. He joins us to discuss Trump's impetuous move to slap tariffs on steel and aluminum, which has provoked reciprocal threats from other trading partners to slap tariffs on bourbon and Harley-Davidson motorcycles, which could lead to a trade war, which Trump is cavalierly concerned about, declaring, quote, trade wars are good and easy to win. Then finally, Mike Stutz joins us in the studio. He is a UCLA alumnus and activist with the Useful Idiots, who led a demonstration at UCLA last week dressed as Louis XVI to protest Steven Mnuchin's appearance on campus, at which the Treasury Secretary's answers to questions from moderator Kai Rizdal of Marketplace and the audience were greeted with hisses and boos, prompting the Treasury Department to seize the videotape record of the event, revoking an agreement to make it public. And joining us now is Ryan Grimm, the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept and the former D.C. Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winning once. He is a contributor to the Young Turks Network and the author of This Is Your Country on Drugs, The Secret History of Getting High in America. And his latest article, co-authored with Clayton Swisher at The Intercept, is Jared Kushner's real estate firm sought money directly from Qatar government weeks before blockade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Grimm.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us, Ryan. And it does seem more than a coincidence, doesn't it, that Jared Kushner's father, well, initially there was a meeting with the former prime minister of Qatar back during the transition, at which I believe Jared asked for $500 million from the Qatar's sovereign wealth fund. And that was turned down. And apparently the father then had a second bite at the apple. I guess, what was it in, was it in June? The blockade was in June, right?
Right, right. The this was the week of April 24th. There
right.
were two meetings held that week.
Right. And then, what, a couple of weeks later, the blockade.
Right. A couple of weeks later, Trump and Kushner go to Riyadh, if you remember. They put their hands on the orb.
Right.
And while there, or shortly thereafter, Trump trashes Qatar for being a funder of terrorism, and the blockade is on around all sorts. The blockade was allegedly around some comments by the Emir of Qatar that Iran was a good thing and the U.S. was bad. That turned out to be an actual piece of fake news that the Qatar news agency had been hacked and the UAE had placed that, according to American intelligence. Sources.
Right. I guess it sounds like the winds are still blowing there in D.C.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know whether you can seek shelter from the wind. But the my understanding is that the real motive on the part of the Saudis, of course, is to shut down Al Jazeera, and that also is very much the motive of the Crown Prince of the Emirates, MBZ, who is something of a mentor of MBS, the boy king in Saudi Arabia. And of course, in Sunday's New York Times now, there's a story that this character, George Nader, a Lebanese-American businessman, has reinvented himself as an advisor to the de facto ruler of the United Arab Emirates, MBZ, who also hosts the private army of Eric Prince's. So there are a lot of players in this, but the people who should be running U.S. foreign policy, at least in terms of that very volatile region that's undergoing a proxy war, essentially, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, were shut out of this altogether, were they not? Rex Tillerson and Secretary
Right,
Defense.
Rex Tillerson, shortly after the blockade that was announced, the Saudi and UAE-led blockade, Kushner undermined Tillerson by giving Trump a message to broadcast just an hour or two after Tillerson had called for the blockade to end and parties to come together and work out their differences. Trump goes out with a Kushner statement, which, you know, Tillerson now believes was a Kushner statement, saying, you know, Qatar needs to be brought to heel and needs to, you know, make hard changes faster and generally supporting the UAE and Saudi effort. And so we still today have an ongoing blockade of Qatar. So the efforts to find some sort of solution in June that were undercut meant that we're months into this crisis now.
And again, I'm speaking with Ryan Grimm, who's a D.C. bureau chief for The Intercept and a former D.C. bureau chief for The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and which they won once. He is a contributor to the Young Turks Network and the author of This Is Your Country on Drugs, The Secret History of Getting High in America. And his latest article at The Intercept is Jared Kushner's Real Estate Firm Sought Money Directly from Qatar Government Weeks Before Blockade. Of course, much of the focus now, Ryan, is on Kushner and his wife, the daughter of the president's fate. And I suppose the speculation is either General Kelly will be left standing or Ivanka, as they called Jared and Ivanka, will be left standing. It seems, that given the record of Trump's reliance upon some of these figures who have left him, like his bodyguard Keith Schiller and Hope Hicks, the assumption is that these are the Jared and Ivanka would be the last two pillars that kind of keep him anchored, because he clearly is quixotic. How do you come down on that speculation, whether it's going to Kelly or Ivanka?
I feel like Kushner is finished whether he leaves the White House or not. Like, he's had his security clearance downgraded to the point where he can't really participate in any meetings of any significance. He can't sit in any meetings with any world leaders where, you know, sensitive information is discussed. The news avalanche that landed upon him this past week has rendered him just politically denuded. And so if he sticks around in his office, that all he'll be is kind of a statue, with an office that has, you know, real estate close to the Oval Office, but little more than that. He would have that even if he went back to New York. Like, let's say he wises up and says, you know what, I was actually not cut out for this. I've never really done anything. I succeeded in anything in my life. It was a little bit hubristic for me to think I could pull this off. So, you know, let's fold up shop before I'm in prison. And he goes back to New York and back to real estate. He would still be able to get Trump on the phone anytime he wanted, as long as Trump was willing to take his calls. And as long as he's married to Ivanka, he probably will. But that's all he has now, is a connection to Trump. He doesn't have much of an, you know, institutional apparatus anymore within the White House with which he could get anything done. If he wanted to guide Middle East policy like he was in the past, he wouldn't really be able to.
Well, but every report that you get from leaked reports and from foreign interactions with Jared, and particularly the recent story that suggested that the governments of Mexico, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Emirates were, and China were all into manipulating the kid because he was so callow and vacuous and ill-informed that he was ripe for the picking and ripe to be manipulated, and also the concerns about the clearances in terms of his vulnerability with this looming debt at 666 Fifth Avenue, it leads you to ask why he ever got the job in the first place. I mean, is Trump that cynical that he doesn't believe that you need qualifications to have the most important portfolios in the U.S. government?
No, I mean, he believes that qualifications are disqualifications. You know, he doesn't have any respect for these book smart people who work their way through life. When he first began to understand that he had thousands of federal employees at his fingertips, it was very hard for him to figure these people out. You know, he's a very good reader of people, as a lot of, you know, real estate people and deal makers and hucksters are. But it failed him a little bit with federal employees because he's like, well, what's their gain? You know, why have these people been working in the State Department for 20 years? What's in it for them? And it's very difficult for him to understand a type of person who's motivated by something other than, you know, individual advancement or profit, and so these bureaucrats that are around, kind of keeping the federal government going, he met with like a mix of confusion and disdain, and so also he's not for all of his bravado and his catchphrase of "you're fired," he's not good at being direct with people. He's barely ever fired anybody personally, if ever. And if Jared comes to him and says, "I want a job in the White House," he doesn't know how to say no. And he even said as much, if you recall, in the book Fire and Fury, he said, "You know, it's family. What can you do? Like, gee, oh, shucks." And if you try to think of the flip side of Hillary Clinton, not just bringing Chelsea Clinton into the White House, but bringing her huckster husband, Mark Mezvinsky, who had some time running a hedge fund that did terribly, and has lived as a ski bum as well. Like, if all of a sudden, like, hey, this guy is an expert, you know, hedge fund manager, we're going to bring him in. He's going to do Middle East peace. I don't think we'd be surprised if it turned out that he used his new position to enrich himself or to get himself out of whatever jams he'd been in before. That's kind of how you would expect someone like that to behave.
Well, my understanding is, though, that it's sort of worse in a way because Trump is also infantile in the way, almost like a preschooler, that if people, you know, that he either finds that are intellectually challenging or have who, as you point out, come out of the sort of selfless world of government service, like H.R. McMaster, for example, the national security advisor, he barely speaks to him because he associates him with sort of bad news and intruding on his little world. And, he doesn't like the attorney general anymore, so he ignores him. It's like kindergarten time. You know, he just ignores people or avoids people that he doesn't like or who challenge him. So his circle is diminishing daily, surely.
Yeah, it does. It does show a robustness in the federal government itself, that the fact that it hasn't collapsed.
Well, that's pretty cold comfort.
Yes. But it is interesting that, outside of the shambolic performance of the people at the top, in many ways it continues to function. In many ways, that the more efficient and effective ideologues that he has put in place, you know, have been able to do real damage because they know what they're doing. But in some ways, the more buffoonish you are, the harder it is for you to do proactive damage. You can, wreak all sorts of havoc, but your ability to undercut it is limited because the organism has some life to it.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Ryan Grimm, I one of a very good Middle East intelligence source I have told me about this story back in September about the shakedown. But subsequent to that, I inquired just a couple of days ago, saying, "Well, what does this mean that they're going to the building's going to take the whole Kushner family down?" And I was told, "No, that they've actually secured the money from MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, and that the last meeting that took place with Kushner and MBS." Kushner brought his brother along, and his brother, of course, is the cutout who's taking care of Jared's shares in the company. And that meeting was quickly followed by the arrests of all of these other Saudi billionaires who are holed up in a luxury hotel, one of whom, the leading internationally recognized billionaire, had the temerity of insulting Donald Trump publicly and suggesting he'd make a terrible president. So you can't have feeling that – do you think there's a second shakedown there? Do you think that the boy king confiscated all that wealth in order to hand it over or hand some of it over to Jared in a final kind of sort of payback for the insult to Trump?
Right. Here's what we know. We know that Kushner Companies is negotiating with Vornado, which owns almost half of 666 Fifth Avenue. They bought it to kind of bail out Kushner earlier. So we know that Kushner Companies is negotiating with them to buy out Vornado, which means they got some money somewhere. And we don't yet know where that money came from. The source being Saudi Arabia is as good a guess as any. I mean, this is a country that dropped $450 million on a painting recently. So coming up with $500 million for a key foreign policy initiative, you might even make some of it back. You're not going to lose all the money. That's certainly a possibility, and I would expect that Mueller is going to look into that, and he should have the subpoena ability to go to the financial intermediaries and unmask whoever is the source of that money. You know, it's hard to move that amount of money without the American government finding out, and it was American government intelligence sources that revealed that it was Saudi that purchased that Da Vinci painting. So I don't know. We'll see. It's a fascinating question of who paid for it. And if it was Saudi Arabia, that has quite some interesting legal implications.
Right. And if Jared is sort of frozen out of the White House, then one wonders whether the $500 million was worth it, right?
Right, right. Well, he did pull off the purge.
That's so true.
Maybe he got what he needed.
Well, Ryan Grimm, thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate you.
Yep, you got it.
Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Grimm, who's the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept and former D.C. Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winning once. He is a contributor to the Young Turks Network and the author of This Is Your Country on Drugs, The Secret History of Getting High in America. And his latest article, co-authored with Clayton Swisher at The Intercept, is Jared Kushner's real estate firm sought money directly from the Qatar government weeks before the blockade. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into Trump's impetuous move to slap tariffs on steel and aluminum.
Payback is a thing you got to see. makes the world go around. The world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Timothy Canova, who's a professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University's Sheppard Broad College of Law. His research crosses the disciplines of law, public finance, economics, and history, and he was an early critic of financial deregulation and warned of the dangers of the bubble economy. He teaches regulation of international financial institutions, international business transactions, international trade and development law, and international monetary law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Canova.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks a lot, Tim. And what did you make of Donald Trump's impetuous announcement the other day, which apparently caught everybody by surprise, particularly his economic team and his Secretary of Treasury, where he announced that he was going to slap 25% tariff on steel imports and 10% tariff on aluminum imports?
Well, I think the economic argument for these tariffs are a little bit suspect. It's likely to result in immediate retaliation from European Union and some other trading partners. It will also probably increase some costs for other American industries that rely on steel and aluminum, from automobiles to beverage cans. And one wonders if it's really worth all of that to try to protect some jobs in industries that are suffering from the effects of automation, maybe more than anything. I would think it would be a more effective way to help employment in those industries to have a major infrastructure program rather than to be picking trade wars with our trading partners.
But apparently Trump, I mean, I don't know whether he can educate somebody like him who you know, is subject to conspiracy theories and seems immovable on belief systems, no matter how wacky they are. He seems to think that American trade deficits with countries like Germany and Germany are happening because the U.S. is being swindled.
Well, I will say that there is a grain of truth in the view that trading partners sometimes manipulate not just trading rules, such as to be able to make subsidies to their industries, but also to devalue or keep their currencies undervalued, which in many ways does help strengthen the dollar. And there are reasons that we might not want to rush into changing the trading relations the way they are. But I do think that line of thinking is pandering to a base in the United States, which feels that they have been overlooked by elites in the past, and that Trump is going to take care of them. Whether a trade war is really going to help these folks is really a whole other matter. I know some of the retaliatory trade actions that have already been raised by the European Union include bourbon from Kentucky and Harley-Davidsons that are made in Wisconsin. And what's ironic is here in South Florida, where we just have suffered the recent mass shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, I've heard students say that they should be starting a boycott of goods and services produced in Kentucky and in Wisconsin to target Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan for not allowing a vote to move forward on any kind of gun regulation reform.
Well, that sounds like a promising move, and it's pretty hard not to notice that the Europeans chose those bourbon and Harley-Davidson for the very reasons that it's McConnell and Ryan that they're targeting. But back on the issue, though, of Trump's sort of limited understanding of economics, the real problem with the U.S. is that we save too little and we consume too much. And we borrow from the rest of the world to keep this whole thing going here. And the truth of the matter is that's exactly what Trump's all about. He, you know, his whole career is about borrowing too much, going bankrupt, and blaming his creditors.
You're absolutely right. And then you take a look at what is his signature issue so far, that or signature accomplishment so far during his presidency. It might be that $1.5 trillion tax cut, which blows a hole in the budget, which was already well in deficit. So U.S. borrowing will only increase as a result of the tax cut and reliance on foreign capital to finance those the twin deficits, the trade deficit and the federal budget deficit.
Well, my understanding is that one of the motives of Trump sort of blurting this thing out and catching Gary Cohn and Mnuchin and others by surprise was that this is something he can do, and that this has always been government by stunt and government by distraction, to distract everybody from the fact that Trump's completely out of his depth and doesn't know what he's doing, and the only thing that he understands is reality television, and you know he's the survivor in the White House, putting on this reality TV show, and you know he threw out this little bombshell at the end, you know, about these tariffs. So mm-hmm. How much of it is did he do this because he can do it?
Well, I think it's a fair question to ask, and that theory makes plenty of sense. You know, it plays to the grievances that a lot of Americans have, and that whole idea of putting America first. Not only does it invite perhaps retaliation from trading partners, and I know Trump has then tweeted, "Bring it on!" Basically, we will win a trade war. But you look in the past; our trading partners have not been afraid not only to retaliate, but also to bring the United States before the World Trade Organization and have the WTO actually rule on the merits of restrictive trade policies by the U.S. Now, I believe that Trump's idea of this big tariff on steel and aluminum imports is premised on WTO provisions allowing for that kind of action based on national security. Now, that's going to be an interesting litigation, you could say, before the WTO, if a trading partners bring us to the WTO. And it's not a slam dunk that the WTO would accept the U.S. argument here. If that's the case, then, you know, we might be facing a situation where the administration is defying the WTO and blowing up one of the mainstays of the world trading system. And, you know, I say that as somebody who myself have been very critical of the WTO, and less on the liberalization of trade and more by its failure to harmonize labor, environmental standards, human rights, things like that, and to allow for, you could say, a delegation of authority to big corporations.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy Canovas, Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeastern University Sheppard Broad College of Law. His research crosses the disciplines of law, public finance, economics, and history, and he was an early critic of financial deregulation and warned of the dangers of the bubble economy. He teaches regulation of international financial institutions, international business transactions, international trade and development law, and international monetary law. And you also, in 2011, you were appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders to serve on an advisory committee on the Federal Reserve reform, and in 2016, you ran for Congress against Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Let's just touch on that for a minute, because you did very well against her, but for reasons which are extraordinary, you challenged the election results, and mysteriously all of the ballots were destroyed by the Florida Electoral Commission. So what's that all about?
Well, we ran a tremendous grassroots campaign and raised money online in small donations. People just go into our website at timcanova.com. And what we did with the funds was we really put it into the district, into a very large grassroots canvassing operation where we were knocking on 10,000 doors a week. And the numbers we were getting back from our canvassing showed a much different result than what the official election result was. So we were very skeptical, and there were election integrity folks who started to do demographic and statistical analyses, and they urged me to challenge the results or to inspect the ballots, really. We put in a public records request to inspect the ballots, and Florida has a very good public records law. Any citizen can make these kinds of requests. And the Broward County Supervisor of Elections stonewalled us for half a year, and we finally brought a lawsuit. And while the lawsuit was pending, the supervisor's office destroyed all of our ballots in violation of the federal requirement to keep the ballots for 22 months, in violation of state requirements, and really in defiance of the court. In destroying the ballots, the supervisor signed an order certifying that the ballots were not even the subject of pending litigation, which was completely false. So we want to get to the bottom of this. We saw way too much election rigging going on in 2016. And what have been the results? Last year, the New York City Board of Elections entered a civil consent decree admitting that they had purged 200,000 voters from their voting list in the days before their presidential primary. And aside from admitting what they had done and promising never to do it again, nothing has come of it. There really needs to be criminal investigations of this kind of mass voter suppression and any kind of election rigging, and certainly destruction of ballots. We cannot have confidence and faith in an election system that destroys ballots. And the United States, when you look at it in international terms, we are near the very bottom of any democracy in the world in terms of how they rate for election integrity and election justice.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's return, and I'd like to follow this up. And you're running again against Debbie Wasserman Schultz in this year's Democratic primary in Florida. So we'll certainly get back to you when that's underway. But let's just touch on the last aspects of this possibility that Trump is going to drag us into a trade war, and we're reliving the Smoot-Hawley disaster of the 1930s. I always think those names, Smoot-Hawley, sound like characters out of a horror film. But Wilbur Ross was the Trump whisperer in this case. He was the one who did an end run around Gary Cohn, Mnuchin, and the chief of staff Kelly, whispered in Trump's ears, and suddenly Trump comes out with this slapping these tariffs on steel and aluminum. It's incredibly coincidental that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary's fortune was made in investing in buying and selling distressed American steel companies who will benefit from this tariff.
You take a look at the entire Trump agenda right now, and it just seems like they are bringing us back to the kind of 1920s policies that resulted in the Great Depression and the kind of policies that resulted in the 2008 financial collapse. Enormous supply-side tax cuts at a time when the super wealthy certainly don't need it, and everyone else from the middle class to the poor are really suffering with stagnant or falling incomes. Like you said, the kind of trade policies that invite trade wars and will raise domestic costs, perhaps, and deregulation on a massive scale, underfunding of the public sector, public austerity, and their solution to that is privatizations. So this is the exact opposite of the direction we need to go in. And I don't mean to redirect it to my campaign, but I will say that that's what the campaign is really about. And that's what the politics of Bernie Sanders in 2016 were really about. Are we going to have this privatization model with, where the wealthy just exploit everybody? Or are we going to have our own generation's New Deal with a public sector that's up to the task of providing for the general welfare?
Well, Timothy Conover, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. It was a pleasure.
And likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Conover, who's a professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad College of Law. His research crosses the disciplines of law, public finance, economics, and history. He was an early critic of the financial deregulation and warned of the dangers of the bubble economy. And he teaches regulation of international finance institutions, international business transactions, international trade and development law, and international monetary law. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be joined in the studio by Mike Stutz, who is a UCLA alumnus and activist with the Useful Idiots, and he led a demonstration at UCLA last week dressed as Louis the 16th to protest Steve Mnuchin's appearance on campus. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining me in the studio is Mike Stutz, who's a UCLA alumnus and activist with The Useful Idiots, an activist group that brings art and humor to the resistance. Last Monday, he dressed as Louis the 16th to protest Steven Mnuchin's public speaking appearance at UCLA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Stutz.
Thank you so much for having me, and glad to be here.
And of course, you were not dressed as that's
yes.
Not your normal wardrobe.
You can inform, right? Yes, you can inform the viewers I am not dressed as Louis XVI
right.
Currently. No.
And your Marie Antoinette,
yes.
your partner, a well-known actress, she prefers to be undercover, right?
Not undercover. She just doesn't want to get too much publicity from it, as the TV world, you know, still likes non-political as the
way to go. I understand that. But it was quite an effective visual. So describe – you were both inside and the outside. Mnuchin was invited by the Buerkle Center, which is financed by a local wealthy guy Buerkle.
Yes.
Ron Buerkle. I think he owns a bunch of supermarkets and was close to the Clintons but had a huge falling out. I don't know whether he's responsible for the invitation, but why did they invite him in the first place? And did they not suspect that he might not be the person representing the Trump administration may not be that welcome in California?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, he's raised all our taxes. I mean, it's not – there is a – I mean, we have – every Californian has a good reason to be angry at the Republicans because they have literally gone after us by raising our taxes.
Which he actually mentioned in the speech itself. When he was being interviewed, he said, well, I'm not getting a tax cut because I live in California, to which people responded. But he said it glibly, like that was hilarious that Californians were being punished. I would guess that they invited him because it's so hard to get the Trump people on the record. And that even though obviously there would be some hostile, you know, reaction to him, at this point they won't appear anywhere that isn't the safest environment possible. So I will give one point of credit to him. He showed up.
Right.
Now, it was a disaster at the moment he walked out on stage, but he was willing to show up.
But the Treasury Department have seized the videotape, which they promised to release to UCLA. And why do you think they did that?
Well, they've sort of bungled it from the beginning. I am sure that they did it because they want to represent it as because he was being heckled, as they say. But in fact, he was not being heckled. He was being protested. But if you were to watch the video, you will see a man who is glaring at the crowd, who is clearly very uncomfortable, who's sort of sweating and not sure what to do, and someone who cannot let go of the idea that people disagree with him. He was absolutely uncomfortable both in his speech and also when he was talking to Kai Ryssdal and all the way through when he was taking questions. He simply couldn't settle in. Someone in the crowd actually said, just ignore them, to which Kai Ryssdal agreed, just ignore them. And if he had and simply had spoken about policy, yes, there would be some hissing and yes, there would be some pushback. But people would have let him talk. The whole point of the hissing was to not try to drown him out, to let him speak, to let him hang himself with his own words. And that's exactly what he did. And then – their reaction to seize the video is, you know, PR 101. It's a nightmare. What could they possibly do to benefit in just adding so much more publicity? Now it's run in media outlets throughout the world, whereas if they just let the video go.
What's run has been cell phone video from but not the whole thing.
No, the video.
There is an audio record, which we have some of from Marketplace. And also, he insulted Kai Ryssdal, the anchor of Marketplace, did he not?
He did. He absolutely treated Kai Ryssdal like he was a business student, that he was just starting out in the business world. He would stop him. He would say, well, I've already answered that. And he says, well, you're not in the meetings. And he really – Kai was very patient with him. There's a certain story out there that Kai was being contentious. He wasn't. He was simply asking questions and actually being, you know, patient with the responses that he got. He was simply asking him to actually explain policy rather than just throw out sort of slogans.
Right.
And he was absolutely – Mnuchin was hostile to everyone in the room. And I hear once he walked off the stage, he was even more hostile.
Well, let's play some of the audio, which we actually got from Marketplace, since there is an audio record. And, of course, we are radio, so the absence of pictures is not hurting us that much. We'll play the video, play the audio now, and we'll be back in conversation in a moment with Mike Stutz, who's a UCA alumnus and activist with the Useful Idiots, an activist group that brings art and humor to the resistance. And last Monday, he dressed as Louis XVI to protest Steve Mnuchin's public speaking appearance at UCLA. Here's a bit of that appearance.
What was it about the president's approach to the American economy that made you say, I want to work for this guy? That's a good point.
No, I think they're going to get more tired than I am. So, you know, that's kind of that chance. Oh, yeah, I'm dealing with students. I forgot. There's a lot of students. So what
was it about the president's economic agenda that made you say, I want to do this and work on this?
Look, I go back to the comment of, you know, the financial crisis impacted lots of people. I operated banks that went under during the financial crisis. I saw the impact of what went on and how important banks are to local communities and the economic issues, and I felt an obligation to try to do things that would help people and help the economy, and particularly the middle class. And I think we're very proud of these accomplishments.
Well, that he certainly glossed over. Mnuchin glossed over an amazing piece of what could you call it? Deliberate obfuscation.
Yes.
When he said, "I was with banks that went under." That's how he made his fortune, out of IndyBank that went under in Pasadena, and then they went and did these robo signings, which are completely illegal. And forced thousands and thousands of people out of their homes.
Over 600,000. He foreclosed on the elderly. He foreclosed on veterans. He made hundreds of millions of dollars taking advantage of the American public, and then has the gall to say, hey, look, I turned this bank around. Isn't that great? I will say one of the angriest looks that he gave in the whole thing was as he was walking off stage, I yelled, all hail the foreclosure king, which he is known as. And boy, he shot me a look. He was not amused by that. He gets quite angry at that name, but it's well deserved. That's how he made his money. It was foreclosing on people.
Well, that's Louis XVI saying that to him, right?
Absolutely. And yes, he certainly noticed. We were in the fifth row looking at him, and he was glaring at us the whole time. He was unamused. And you know,
us meaning Marie Antoinette sitting beside you.
Marie Antoinette and I were sitting there, and it was low-hanging fruit. I mean, he's been called – he and his wife, Louise, you know, with their various adventures where they are hashtagging, you know, high-end products on their pictures of them gallivanting around the world on taxpayer dollars. They have been called Louis and Marie before, so it just seemed, you know, between him being the foreclosure king and her being Marie Antoinette, it was just too easy dressing as the king and queen.
So there was one of the video clips that I saw, obviously taken by a cell phone because the video record was removed by the Treasury Department. It was a very young – what, he was a sixth grader? It's a very good question he asked.
An excellent question. And it simply asked how can you – essentially, how can you live with yourself when you're saddling future generations with all of this debt?
In order to give tax breaks to the 1% who don't need it.
Absolutely.
That was the context of the question.
Yeah, it was a very eloquent question, well asked and I think well deserving of an answer. And of course, he tried to come back with, well, isn't that nice that a young fella asked that question? The audience had none of that. Someone screamed, answer the question. Right. And then he sort of glossed around it the way he does. But he gave no significant answer to a generation that deserves answers from this administration.
Right. So tell us about your group, the Useful Idiots. Of course, that's a KGB term.
Yes.
Polyezhny Durak, meaning, and they usually it's gullible Westerners who either wittingly or unwittingly toe the Russian line, which, of course, is a big part of the Mueller inquiry. About who was a useful idiot and who was an active collaborator. And eventually, of course, hopefully at the end of the day, we'll learn what who's who in that, gallery of criminals
yes.
that are running this country at the moment. So you're a group that brings art and humor to the resistance. You certainly did in this in the case of Steve Mnuchin's appearance at UCLA. No question about that. But I guess that's really, in many ways, the cleverest part of it all. I mean, why politics are so depressing now, and covering Trump is like the daily dose of doom. But occasionally, when things like what you guys did at UCLA, and there's another example where I just got a real shot in the arm when Michael Flynn was arraigned before the special prosecutor. Some citizen out there in D.C. held up a sign, lock him up. And as you remember, Mike Flynn famously at the Republican convention led the chant of lock her up, lock her up. And of course, being a military officer in the United States Army, he had to know better. And that was just disgraceful behavior. And I thought, my God, that's wonderful. There are citizens in this country who just are taking this BS head on.
Absolutely. And, we try to put out a message that can bring some humor and hopefully some thoughtful response to what's going on. And with folks like Mnuchin and with Trump and Flynn and others, they sort of universally lack a sense of humor. So we like to – they really don't like to be made fun of. So we take advantage of that. We like to amplify a progressive message by creating a look. Something that we can focus on, something that also, whether it's pictures or video, something to sort of supplement the rally for organizers. So we have been at probably about 50 or so rallies and protests in Southern California this year. We have members all over the country and, we're a loose group. The group really started – I showed up to a rally wearing a chicken suit and it said, don't be chicken, keep fighting back. And I thought, I'm an absolute idiot. What am I doing? And showed up. People cheered. The press was there. I talked to a lot of different press and I thought there's something to this. People want to have symbols that they can look towards and things that they can have fun with at these rallies and protests because you're there for a long time. And I got some friends together who were entertainers and actors and directors, and we sort of grew and kept growing. And we have been, we came as ex-presidents, sort of dead presidents and historical figures to the tax march, we came as Russians to the tax march, and we came to an impeachment rally as all ex-presidents carrying a coffin that said on it, the U.S. presidency with the dates, 1789 to 2017. So we try to, come at it with some sense of humor because you want to bang your head on a desk these days with everything that's going on. So the way that we fight, I write comedy. I work as a director in comedy, and the way I fight despair is with humor. And so far it's worked pretty well and we've actually gotten some pretty good results and I think have gotten a message out that needs to be out there.
Well, I think in Trump's case, though, I think he has despotic tendencies.
Oh, absolutely.
The fact that he did the most outrageous thing, which was to congratulate Xi Jinping on declaring himself a leader for life and getting rid of term limits – and essentially giving the Chinese leader permission to become more of a dictator at the expense of the Chinese people, who are losing their freedom daily, losing their ability to communicate on the internet, to be free. All those trends, those hopeful trends of China becoming an ordinary member of the globe, not just an economic power, but also an incipient democracy. That's all been rolled back. And the president of the world's most important and longest-lasting democracy, instead of chastising Xi Jinping or encouraging him to reverse this direction towards despotism, is encouraging him. How do you figure that?
It's shocking. I mean, his disregard for other human beings, beyond just being a president, he has no regard for human life. He has no regard for the suffering of others. He thinks that it's all a game, as your previous guest was talking about. You know, it's a reality show to him, and it's something that he – shocking is good. And I don't know if he doesn't realize the damage that he does with every action and with every tweet and with every phrase that he utters, or if he just doesn't care. And I'm afraid it may be that he just doesn't care.
Right, but you'd think somewhere along the line, since he's grew up in this country, he'd be able to recognize, you know, the value of American democracy.
I'm not sure that a true narcissist like Trump really has much regard for democracy. I think it's every man for himself.
Right. Well, back to his cabinet, though. I mean, of all of the people, though, when you say you like to, you know, cut down these tall poppies, these arrogant types who have been elevated to the position of running this country at the moment, or running it into the ground, depending upon your perspective. Mnuchin seems to be the most caricaturable, if there's a word, because I watch him at these press conferences and he's acting like, a character in a movie. I know he's a movie producer here for a while. Terrible movies, by the way.
Suicide Squad being his creation.
Yeah, I know, but he did that film with Ben Affleck where they just kill people like crazy. Horrible, horrible, hateful stuff. But he sort of, you know, when he does a press conference, he's deliberately sort of talking down to the reporters, next question, you know, like he's in charge. He's got this air, but he's, as somebody, one of his classmates from Yale said, Mnuchin put the douche in fiduciary. He just doesn't pull it off, does he?
No, he seems to be acting a role. And I think that was what really hurt him at his speech and interview, was that he, when he's in safe environments or photo ops, he can play this role of you know, the kind of hip, knowledgeable business guy. Right. But when he's actually – when it's he's exposed for, you know, the emperor or the emperor's treasury secretary having no clothes, he suddenly starts fumbling and becomes the sort of awkward, sad guy that he is. I had said to someone after the rally, if he wasn't doing such terrible things, I would have almost felt sorry for him. Right. Because I think that he was exposed for who he really is, which is – a small-minded, egotistical, vain leader who desperately loves the power and loves the prestige of his position. And you see that with even the pictures that he and his wife post. It's all about he might as well be posting every picture of him in a Ferrari driving along the beach.
Right. It's kind of a political version of the Kardashian type of
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. They approach it the same way, you know, our modern day celebrities. He is truly a treasury secretary for our age, for the Instagram age. And I don't mean that as a compliment in any way, shape or form.
Right. Well, the wife, of course, who tweeted out that picture of her, named every piece of designer clothes when they went down to actually see the eclipse at Fort Knox. And apparently he showed her all the gold, which presumably – and there's, of course, pictures of them holding up sheets of freshly minted U.S. Currency as well. But I recall a taxpayer had tweeted back to her basically saying that this is a bit much, that you guys are running around in government jets – doing, you know, to watch the eclipse of the sun on our dime. And the response from Louise Linton was so patronizing. It was like, oh, you're adorably out of touch.
We pay so much taxes. You know, we're the ones funding the government. Yes, this couple who wanted the government to pay for their honeymoon in Europe. Yes, Louise has a unique way of expressing herself and just can't help herself. And it is that approach is what Louis and Marie came from. Let them eat cake. It could be his slogan and certainly her slogan.
And your counterpart who was addressed as Marie Antoinette, didn't she have a sign up saying let them eat cake?
Let them eat cake. And we also had sheet cake. We were giving out cake to the crowd outside of the venue. We didn't think we'd actually be allowed in. We hadn't made a reservation. But when we came up, we thought, well, we might as well give it a shot. And they put us on standby. And sure enough, there were empty seats. So there was no rule against costumes. So, you know, that I guess next time maybe they'll scratch that into the rules.
Did you have to go through the wanding?
Well, we went through the wanding. Absolutely. There's a great video that's out on a lot of the media outlets of Marie Antoinette being wanded. And they didn't know what to do with all of our buttons. We had gold buttons everywhere. But they were, you know, they were very nice, and I will say that the
they're Secret Service, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
They would be Secret Service.
Yes. Secret Service and the police were very nice and accommodating. I mean, very professional and obviously doing their jobs. They were pretty nervous when we walked in. When we sat down, we sort of did a little parade around. We walked around looking at the VIP seats, and we got more applause than Mnuchin did. But once we sat down,
that's probably pissed him off.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. But the security was pointing at us and quite upset. But as they realized that we were not there to break it up, we were not going to stop them from anything. They were very accommodating.
Right. Well, look, I'm glad you came by. It's always great to have studio guests.
Yeah.
Particularly in your case, I get a real kick out of people like you. You know, I think we all have to be activists. We all have to be in the resistance. We can't count on – certainly can't count on impeachment or count on this guy having a meltdown and being taken out in a, you know, a straitjacket. There's a lot of hard work ahead to save this country from this terrible mistake the American people made in electing this man who's so clearly dangerous and unqualified and seems to be getting more and more crazy by the day. And his lieutenants like Mnuchin – are truly among the most disgraceful people to ever have walked on this planet.
Oh, absolutely. Those who excuse his behavior are as bad or worse than he is.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Mike Stutz.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Stutz, who's a USA alumnus and activist with the Useful Idiots, an activist group that brings art and humor to the resistance. Last Monday, he dressed as Louis XVI to protest Steven Mnuchin's public speaking appearance at UCLA. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.